All right. So speaking about the CLL treatment paradigm, just to start off, what are some disease factors and patient characteristics that affect your treatment decision-making for the first-line setting for patients with CLL?
Yeah. So I think that when I think about frontline treatment for CLL, there are obviously so many amazing options. There's sort of a multitude of ways with which we can do this. We have, you know, fixed duration therapies, either with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. We, you know, have acalabrutinib with venetoclax with or without obinutuzumab, now compendium listed, and likely we'll see an approval in the future. And then we have continuous treatment with zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib as sort of the preferred regimens of the second generation BTK inhibitors. Now, the first thing that comes into play is actually patient preference as to which type of treatment they would like to undergo, whether or not they would prefer a fixed duration regimen or a continuous treatment. And I think a lot of logistical factors go into that, and that we're very lucky to be able to, you know, allow patients to really choose what it is their frontline treatment therapy is in a way in which that it works within the context of their lives and their ability to even get from clinic and their, you know, the time that they, you know, want to spend in the physician's office at the beginning of their CLL treatment journey. So I think that those are sort of that's the first factor for me. From sort of disease specific factors, I think we take into account whether or not patients have high risk mutations such as deletion 17p or TP53 mutation. We do have the most prospective data for continuous BTK inhibition in this setting. Most recently, you know, with the recent updates from Sequoia Arm C of zanubrutinib monotherapy. And some people would say that, you know, because of the high risk nature of these diseases and the way in which the disease biology of the CLL acts, you know, perhaps continuous agents are the preferred regimen here. I think that that's still a little bit of a debated topic. Those patients have been included in some prospective randomized phase 3 studies of fixed duration treatment, although albeit we have much shorter outcomes and really only have 3, 4, 5, and 6 years of follow-up data for us to understand whether or not that's the preferred regimen. I would say that for patients, you know, with a deletion 17p or TP53 that are highly motivated to do fixed duration treatment, it's a long conversation as to the pros and cons of this and often letting patients know that they may have a short of time off of treatment before requiring a second line of systemic therapy. And then in terms of other patient-specific factors, I think thinking about patient fitness, and so that's not just age chronologically, but sort of biological age and other comorbid conditions such as cardiac issues like hypertension, history of arrhythmias, history of AFib does come into play. Oil is not, does not make patients ineligible to receive one particular line of treatment or another. Thinking about patients that have chronic kidney disease, thinking about other medications that patients may be on that could interact, particularly warfarin, which becomes a challenge with our covalent BTK inhibitors, all come into play when I'm thinking about what a patient will receive for frontline treatment for CLL.
In this era where we're using really targeted therapies for patients, the two that really stand out to me are TP53 aberrations, so either deletion of 17p or TP53 point mutations, which are detected by NGS, and IGHV mutation status. We know that patients with those abnormalities historically have had poor outcomes, and they do much better with targeted therapies. But across our different targeted therapy, either monotherapies or combinations, we do see some differences in those populations. And so I think those particular factors are important to me from the disease-related factor. On the patient front, I think here we see, you know, quite clearly there is a shift towards more fixed-duration therapies, and that is something that I think our patients really preference, is to be on therapies for a fixed finite duration of time. But for some patients, that's not a priority. So if, for example, that treatment comes with increased monitoring or more travel to the clinic site in order to deliver that fixed duration therapy, then I find patients who say, you know, that's not for me. I'm fine with taking continuous therapy if it means less intensive upfront monitoring or less frequent visits to the clinic. So those are some of the logistical factors that patients express that I find really important to tease out for frontline therapy.
So then really, what factors contribute to your treatment sequencing decisions in the second line and later settings?
Yeah. So again, this becomes, again, a little bit less, more so patient preference. And often we have to start thinking about, you know, well, what did patients get in the frontline setting? How did they respond to it? What were their side effect profiles? And then what was the time at which they were last treated for CLL? So from a fixed duration perspective, if somebody is off venetoclax, obinutuzumab, or a venetoclax-based regimen for more at least a year or more, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we do know that venetoclax retreatment strategies are feasible and effective in this particular patient population. So that's a potential consideration. For patients that are treated with a venetoclax-based fixed duration regimen and have a shorter time off treatment, it may be there that we're thinking more about whether or not patients will go on to get a continuous BTK inhibitor in that scenario. And then for patients who are treated with a continuous BTK inhibitor in the frontline setting, the first question is, did they progress while they were on therapy or had they stopped therapy for an intolerance or a side effect and then were off treatment and then progressed? That I do think changes how we may look at treatment options for those patients. You know, now post-covalent BTK inhibitors, we have the choices of venetoclax-based regimen, pirtobrutinib now without having had a prior venetoclax-based regimen, or sometimes an alternative BTK inhibitor in the setting of time off of treatment and intolerance if there's no resistance mutations that are present in a patient's CLL clone, like a C481S or something else, which may make a covalent inhibitor not function well, are all potentially options.
Yeah. So here in second line, a lot of times what we're thinking about is what is the response to the frontline therapy? Fortunately for most patients with CLL today, it's fairly unusual for patients to not respond at all to frontline therapy. Rather, when, for example, patients have had fixed duration therapy in the frontline setting, then I might think about how long were they off treatment? How long did they maintain that remission in the frontline? Is it important to them to potentially again receive a fixed duration therapy? What are the biologic risk factors they have now? So certain features like, for example, P53 aberration can be acquired. So they may not have had them in the frontline setting, but they may be enriched for those at relapse. So I'll often test again for those. And so there we think about, again, the duration of initial response, if they had fixed duration therapy, what their biologic factors are now. And then the other is really their tolerance of certain therapies. If somebody, for example, has been on a continuous BTK inhibitor and had some specific adverse events, then that may be helpful in thinking about, okay, what therapies do we maybe want to avoid in the second line, or what therapies might we be able to deliver safely that don't have those same toxicities?
And so then, that being said, how do you determine when is the optimal time for a patient to switch from their first to second line of therapy?
Right now, the guidelines recommend switching to another line of therapy at the time of progressive CLL. And so that would be similar guidelines to when we would initiate treatment. So seeing a progressive lymphocytosis, progressive lymphadenopathy and splenomegaly B symptoms, and new or worsening cytopenia such as anemia and thrombocytopenia. I think it's a little bit more challenging, and for patients perhaps that have higher risk disease, where you may not want to let patients CLL have a lot of time off treatment. So for example, for patients with deletion 17p, sometimes if we start to see early signs of progression, we'll often start treatment then. Currently, there is no data for us to suggest that for patients that are asymptomatic, that treating earlier at the time of relapse will lead to better outcomes, similar to what we see in the frontline setting.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think differs a little bit in patients who, say, received upfront fixed duration therapy. In that setting, they're often having very deep responses, potentially even undetectable MRD level responses. And so there I would say, I don't treat patients purely for asymptomatic relapses. So we know that patients will eventually relapse, but they may be feeling very well. They may not have cytopenias. They may not have any lymphadenopathy that impacts their life. And so for patients who have what we would call essentially biochemical recurrence, you can detect it in blood work or you can detect it by an MRD assay. I watch those patients closely over time, and we're really then implementing treatment in the second line when they meet IWCLL criteria for treatment. For patients who have been on continuous therapy, like a continuous BTK inhibitor, I think here, similarly so, some patients can maintain a good clinical status, even if they have evidence of disease progression. So for example, maybe their acute or absolute lymphocyte count is starting to rise over time. That alone is not usually a trigger for me to switch therapy, but I might be able to follow that and look at the kinetics of that and try to anticipate, okay, where are we starting to see the earliest changes in their other blood counts, red cells, neutrophils, platelets, or are they starting to have symptoms they didn't, like fatigue or lymph nodes that are causing discomfort. So I think in both settings, we still initiate treatment when patients meet those IWCLL criteria, but how we monitor them in between first-line therapy and second-line therapy may differ a little bit based on whether they had fixed-duration therapy up front or on a continuous BTK inhibitor.
Is there anything that you wanted to add about your decision-making when deciding between covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors for any given patient?
Currently, in my own practice, I have not been using a non-covalent inhibitor before using a covalent inhibitor. We don't have data yet that tells us enough information about how patients will do with a covalent inhibitor post-non-covalent. We'll learn some of this now that we have data from the most recent Bruin study comparing pirtobrutinib to bendamustine rituximab, which was actually late-breaking yesterday at ASH. So I think once we had some more longer-term follow-up data from that data set, as well as understanding how patients respond to treatments post-non-covalent BTK inhibitor in the frontline setting, we'll have a better understanding as to where covalent versus non-covalent fit in the treatment algorithm. But for me, currently, I'm not using pirtobrutinib before a covalent inhibitor just due to the lack of data. And that is also within the FDA label that now allows for patients to receive pirtobrutinib after a covalent BTK inhibitor alone. Prior to this, it was after a prior covalent BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor. So I do think that's one of the major changes that's happened in the course of the last month. I'm also probably still using pirtobrutinib more personally after both covalent inhibitors and venetoclax-based regimens based off of my own clinical experience with the medications and sort of how well patients respond to that in that third line setting. And then using pirtobrutinib potentially as a bridge to things like cellular therapies.
Yeah, so this is becoming an increasingly important question. Up until now, we have largely only had non-covalent inhibitors in later line settings. At this year's ASH, we had trial results that really help us to think about the opportunity or possibility for even frontline use if they are approved in that setting. So what I think is most notable is that most patients do very well with covalent inhibitors up front. The toxicity profile for second generation covalent BTK inhibitors is very good. But there are going to be patients, for example, in whom there are certain adverse events that you want to avoid. So for example, with covalent inhibitors, we can occasionally see hypertension be an issue with some. We can see things like bleeding be a limitation. Interestingly, for non-covalent inhibitors, pirtobrutinib specifically, we do seem to have a differentiated adverse event profile. And what I noted in some of the updated trials that were presented in ASH this year is that even something like bleeding, which we take as a class-specific adverse event, the rates of bleeding, even minor bleeding, seem to be lower for pirtobrutinib. So there may be select patients where we say, okay, there are really specific adverse events that we want to avoid. Maybe that's a patient we can use a non-covalent inhibitor up front, an older, frailer patient, for example. But I think for most patients, because of the track record and the longevity of data we have with covalent BTK inhibitors, that tends to be the first BTK inhibitor we'll use. And then often we're thinking about non-covalent BTK inhibitors in second line or later settings.
How would you describe the safety profile of pirtobrutinib? And, do treatment-related toxicities affect your decision to use this agent in any cases?
I think it can. I think what we are going to see is that for patients that are older or more frail, who maybe will only require one line of CLL-directed therapy to get to their natural lifespan, I think that we will start to see, that pirtobrutinib could be useful in these scenarios because pirtobrutinib is very well tolerated. We've seen pretty consistent safety data since the initial Bruin study of a very well-tolerated medication from a cardiac perspective, as well as in terms of bleeding risk. So I do think that, you know, when we look at the rates of hypertension and atrial fibrillation, they are quite low. And so for patients perhaps that have a lot of cardiac comorbidities, this could be, and only again, are going to, we know at this time, are only going to potentially require one prior line of therapy. You know, pirtobrutinib is immensely well tolerated. And so I do think that there's a consideration for those patients. But that's a very select subgroup.
Yeah. So pirtobrutinib is, I think, a really important drug in CLL. It was first approved in the setting of patients having previously had a covalent BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 antagonist. And so we know that it can be active in that setting when people are so-called double exposed. We've also seen now increasing data sets in earlier lines starting last year at ASH and then this year at ASH in two different trials. Frontline trial in particular looked at pirtobrutinib compared to chemoimmunotherapy in patients for whom chemoimmunotherapy at the time the study was designed was considered a standard. So we now have frontline data with a relatively short follow-up, about 2 years. And what we see across all the different trials for pirtobrutinib is that it has a very high level of activity. It has the potential to deliver deep responses in a subset of patients, and it has a differentiated safety profile. Ultimately, we don't know yet whether we should sequence non-covalent inhibitors first. I think one of the unanswered questions from these trials is that we don't know what happens in patients who get a frontline non-covalent inhibitor like pirtobrutinib. Will they respond to a covalent BTK inhibitor at the time they progress or relapse? We do know the opposite, where patients who have had covalent BTK inhibitors can respond to pirtobrutinib in second line or later. So for me today, I think I will continue to use covalent BTK inhibitors up front. But again, for that patient who has specific needs, in particular, perhaps older, frailer patients, patients who have a higher bleeding risk, is that a circumstance in which I would use pirtobrutinib? Perhaps. I think the trial data tell us that from the efficacy perspective, this drug can work very well for those patients and it can be delivered safely. So there may be a small subset of patients today that we think about, but ultimately as time goes on and that trial matures and we have longer follow-up, we'll have a much better idea, I think, of how to sequence pirtobrutinib with our currently available covalent BTK inhibitors.
Just looking at ASH, I know you spoke a little bit about some CLL data that were presented, but any other CLL data from this year's meeting that really stood out to you?
I think that there was a few things. You know, I think we're seeing, you know, that MRD or measurable residual disease treatment strategies are really being utilized in frontline setting in clinical studies for us to understand, you know, treatment intensification as well as de-intensification. I think that those results are really interesting. We have some longer term follow-up from the Cristallo trial looking at immune reconstitution post venetoclax of inotuzumab, which I think is interesting. Last year, Dr. Cortez from Roswell Park presented some data in a smaller from their own treatment experience demonstrating that after, you know, time off of treatment from venetoclax of inotuzumab, we are seeing immune reconstitution in CLL patients. I think that that's an exciting area. You know, we know that the things that CLL patients die from are progressive CLL infections and other types of cancer, so secondary malignancies. And so while we have very effective strategies for taking care for the CLL portion of this, we have less strategies for the challenges from immunodeficiency and the infectious complications related to CLL and CLL treatment. And similarly, we probably don't have enough data to understand how we manage secondary primary malignancies in these patients, because there is a concern that there's slightly different disease biology there. So we do think that as we tackle some of these other issues, we'll ensure patients with CLL continue to live longer lives.
One of the plenary presentations was the CLL17 study. I think this was a really important study. This study essentially looked at the question of whether a fixed duration combination therapy was non-inferior to continuous BTK inhibitors. So very briefly, the trial looked at randomizing patients to continuous ibrutinib monotherapy, venetoclax and obinutuzumab for about 1 year of therapy, or venetoclax and ibrutinib. And in an early follow-up, about 3 years, what we see is the study met its endpoint for non-inferiority, meaning that the outcomes in patients who received fixed duration therapy, specifically venetoclax and inotuzumab, were not worse than those other arms. So I think because we recognize that time-limited therapy may have advantages for patients, meaning that they're not on drug, meaning that they can't, they may not be incurring the expense of certain medicines, they may not have the continuous risk of adverse events, this trial, I think, really affirms that time-limited therapy or fixed-duration combinations should really be the way forward. I think there were some subtle takeaways from that study that are important, is that when we look in different risk subgroups, we do see that there may be different numerical outcomes. And so this is where I'd say non-inferiority trials, there's always a margin where we say we're willing to accept different outcomes to a certain degree. And I think that's a question that is really open-ended, right? So in some of our high-risk patients, for example, we saw that the progression-free survival numerically was a little bit less in the patients treated with VNO than it was, say, with a BTK-based strategy. So that's an important study, and we'll learn a lot more from the long-term follow-up. And then I mentioned there were two trials of pirtobrutinib, one comparing it to ibrutinib, both in frontline patients and relapse refractory patients. That study demonstrated that pirtobrutinib was at least as effective as ibrutinib. That was also a non-inferiority trial, but had a differentiated safety profile. And then another study looking at pirtobrutinib versus bendamustine rituximab in previously untreated patients. I think that trial, one could argue that the field has shifted away from delivering chemoimmunotherapy like bendamustine and rituximab. So ultimately, the comparator is not as important. But what I gathered from that study was that the outcomes, at least, of the two-year follow-up time for patients treated with pirtobrutinib as their first therapy for CLL looked quite good. So longer-term follow-up is really important there. But we look to the future congresses to see how those patients are doing.